Only installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2007 series presents Visions of Time in Early Modern Europe by Anthony Grafton on Tuesday, March 6th at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. More information is available at www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, once again, we'll have two programs from the Focus 580 archives. This time, we're going back to 2005 for the show. It's the first program first broadcast in April of 2005. And as you listen here this morning, do keep in mind that today we'll not be taking your calls. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with Roger Atwood about his book, Stealing History, Tomb Raiders, Smugglers, and the Looting of the Ancient World, in which he makes the point that tomb raiding is certainly nothing new. However, today it has become a huge global industry, stripping countries of their heritage and at the same time distorting the historical record. In the book, he explores the extent of this robbery, some of the very large amounts of money involved, and takes a look at the market forces that drive the hunt for stolen artifacts. The book is published by St. Martin's Press and should be out now if you'd like to take a look at it. Our guest, Roger Atwood, is a regular contributor to Art News and Archaeology magazines, and his articles on culture and politics have appeared in a number of publications, including The New Republic, Mother Jones, The Nation, The Washington Post, and The L.A. Times. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Atwood, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
As I mentioned in the introduction, and you make the point in the book, what we're talking about as a phenomenon is not new. You write about it this way. The Romans looted the tombs and temples of the Greeks. The Vandals looted Rome. And then European colonialists looted nearly everyone. Most of the tombs in Egypt's Valley of the Kings were robbed within a years of their sealing. Even the famously pristine tomb of Tutankhamun had been penetrated at least twice in antiquity before Howard Carter found it in 1922. Mexicans, before the arrival of the Spaniards, were known to appropriate items from the tombs of their forebears, the Olmecs. The modern antiquities market dates from as far back as the 18th century, when European travelers started returning home from Greece and the Levant with classical carvings, sculpture, and relics. Having said all that, you do go on to say that the antiquities trade today is nothing like that, those historical examples. How is what's going on today so very different from what has happened in the past?
Well, what is happening now in the antiquities trade is that it's all gotten very globalized and streamlined and very, very efficient, and it works with a very systematic kind of efficiency to eliminate whole tombs and eliminate whole the archaeological record in whole parts of the world to bring antiquities to buyers in market countries. It works with much greater efficiency now than it used to. We all know that the antiquities trade has been going on for a long time, and lots of people know about Lord Elgin, the British ambassador to the Ottoman Empire in the early 19th century, taking down the marbles from the Parthenon in Athens and then shipping them all to London. And I do talk about that case in my book and how that case started the whole modern thinking about cultural property and the value of preserving cultural property as a historical record and as a physical record of the ancient world. But I think what is really happening now is that with greatly increased air links and much greater roads, the great increase in container shipping around the world, the antiquities trade is able to get the goods from the source to the market with much greater speed and in much greater volume than they ever have in the past, ever in human history. So what we have now is a greater volume and a greater variety of antiquities on the market than there has ever been in human history, and that they can get incredibly quickly. I've talked with looters in Peru. I interviewed quite a lot of them for the book who have pieces that they sell to middlemen who then bring them to the United States or to Europe the next day. And that didn't happen before, that kind of speed with which things get to the market and it's with which things can get to market. And that's made the market incredibly sensitive to market wishes. It's allowed the demands of consumers, in this case collectors and dealers and unfortunately sometimes museums in the buyer countries such as the United States, to kind of set the market, make the market, and determine which kinds of cultures and civilizations will sort of come into fashion in the market. So you see different cultures, different civilizations coming into fashion. For a time, it was Mayan and particularly Guatemalan stonework, and then Khmer stone carvings from Cambodia for a time, West African funerary objects from the Niger Basin in West Africa. Mesopotamian antiquities have come into fashion, and the looting market responds to that by providing these things, and they're provided by looters. They're not that the pieces aren't sort of sitting in collections waiting for their day in the sun in the market. The pieces are actually provided by looters who then pass them on to middlemen, and then the pieces are then smuggled out of the country to the market nations.
Yeah. You, in the book, you try to look at the various people who are involved in this process, all sort of step by step all along the way, starting with the people who are doing the looting. And
yeah.
As you say, you spent a lot of time in Peru with people. Actually, you did actually go out with some people who were involved in looting tombs of a people called the Moche, which was... a significant, certainly would have been, anybody would consider it a very significant archaeological find, and produced a lot of very beautiful and to collectors, very desirable material.
That's true. And the reason I did that was because I wanted to, there were really two reasons that I did that, that I went out with looters and actually saw them digging up tombs, which is, by the way, a very nauseating and violent sight. Partly is because I wanted people to see people who buy antiquities, who buy undocumented, unprovenanced antiquities, antiquities that don't have any chain of ownership showing that they were excavated by archaeologists. I wanted to describe so people could actually see how these things actually come to market and where they're actually found. And they're found in tombs, and they're the product of grave robbing. And a lot of people don't realize that, because as I was researching this book, I realized that when I talked to people about antiquities and where they came from, people had this idea, and a lot of dealers sort of put out this idea that they were just sort of found by chance, that people found them, farmers found them tilling their fields or digging ditches, or they just sort of, appear in the ground, and that's not the case at all. And I wanted to show that. They are found by commercial grave robbing, and by very large-scale commercial grave robbing, sometimes involving heavy machinery such as front loaders and bulldozers. And also I wanted to show very clearly how the antiquities trade is very much connected to looters, and how looters are the providers of the raw material for the modern antiquities trade, which, as I said before, has nothing to do, or very little to do, with the classical antiquities trade. We have a modern, globalized, efficient antiquities trade now, which has really sprung up in the last 20, 30 years, and which is gradually obliterating a very large record of the physical, a very large part of the physical record of the ancient world. I think it already has, in some countries, basically obliterated the archaeological remains of certain parts of certain countries.
Are these people who are deliberate, educated enough so that they know what the value is of the material that they steal, what can sell and what not? Or, on the other hand, are they people who are poor people, essentially, who see it only as another way of scratching out a living?
I think that they're mostly the first part you described, mm-hmm. the looters who are very much in business. So professional grave robbers are not terribly poor. They're not, the poorest of the poor in most of these countries. They're people who are basically small businessmen whose job is to find ancient sites and destroy them for the antiquities trade, to feed the antiquities trade. Most of the, let's say high-quality grave robbing, to use that expression, is done by people who are professional grave robbers who've been doing it all their adult lives, and they know what they're doing, and they have a great empirical knowledge about how to find sites. They have knowledge that in some ways kind of mirrors that of the archaeologists in how to find ancient sites. And they are very much connected with what the market wants, with the ease of communication now with the internet and email and, much greater telephone links everywhere in the developing world. It's much easier for these tomb raiders to be in touch with what dealers are wanting in places like New York or London There was for a long time, and there is to some extent still in some countries, grave robbing associated with poverty and associated also with ritualistic and some ceremonial properties. But that, at least in Peru, where which I take as a kind of case study for this whole trade, and which I talk about a lot in this book because it's very important to see the transformation of grave robbing, at least in Peru, that ritual and ceremonial aspect has gradually disappeared and been taken over by the more commercial aspect of it, by the commercial grave robbing. That's that really is what feeds the antiquities trade. So, and I think the association with poverty is constantly is getting less and less. It's becoming more and more of an industry.
Are these people working what are established sites, or do they actually go out and find new ones that before had not been known?
They're finding new sites all the time, every night, constantly finding new sites. There is some there is some problem at established archaeological sites with theft from those sites, with looters breaking into them and digging up, you know, by the light of the moon. That does happen a lot. There have been some very well-known cases of that, but it's I would think most antiquities getting onto the market, the great majority of antiquities getting onto the market, are from tombs that have tombs or ancient sites that have been looted recently or looted freshly, and I think that's very, very important to bear in mind.
Mm-hmm. How much money can these people make from their activities?
Nothing like what, you know, dealers who deal in undocumented antiquities make, of course, but a little bit more than you might think. It's not, you know, $5 here, $10 there. They are in better touch with what these pieces actually get on the open market. They know a little bit more about what prices are in the great art dealing capitals than we might expect. I was going around with some looters in Peru who dug up an Inca textile, which they sold to one of their middlemen for $1,000, which really surprised me at the quantity of that. But these were a team of three looters who dug up tombs every night up on the southern coast of Peru, and one night dug up this very beautiful textile from the grave of some Inca commoners. A lot of people are surprised to hear that textiles can survive that long, about almost 500 years, but they do in the very arid climate of Peru. So the textile was in very great condition, and I heard them dickering over the phone with their middleman who takes things out of the country. And they sold it to him for $1,000. A textile that I, looking at it, it's hard for me to say because I'm not an appraiser, but it looked to me like it would be worth about maybe $7,000 in the art market here.
I wonder how it is, having had the opportunity to talk to some people who do this, how it is they think about what they're doing, and do they think about it in terms of their selling off pieces of their heritage, or do they think about this more as a natural resource that they are mining and don't think any more of that than they would if they were digging gold nuggets out of the ground?
I think they see it. Every time I tried to ask the looters about that, ask them that sort of that question you just asked, you know, don't you think that you're kind of, you know, digging up your heritage? Aren't you sort of selling off, you know, this is who you are. This is your past. And wouldn't it bother you if somebody dug up your tomb and stole things that your family had buried with you? And I think they kind of package it in their minds and in a way that, you know, that justifies it by saying, well, you know, there are people who want these things. You know, these people are dead. They're not around to protest. So, you know, why not sell these things? And I see arguments like that all through the antiquities trade, all the way up to dealers and to collectors. There's always a kind of justification for it. You have to defend this in your mind in some ways if you're going to be dealing in commercially pillaged objects. And that, you know, you'll hear dealers saying, well, these people are always digging up these things anyway. These people have been looting these tombs for hundreds of years. So, you know, what's the problem with them continuing to do it? Or they'll say, well, they're not really worthy of these treasures anyway. I'll take better care of it than they will. Or they'll say, well, what good is it doing if it's just sitting in a tomb in Peru? You know, I'll take care of it and display it. And there's always this kind of denial, I think, going on all through the antiquities trade. And one of the things I'm hoping to do with this book is to kind of break through that denial a little bit and expose the psychology behind the trade in undocumented antiquities and how really corrosive it is.
Yeah. Well, it seems that you get at a very important point there, and that is the attitude that's taken by people who trade in these things, people who collect them. And after all, it is the justification that we have for museums as well. All of these people think, on one level, they seem to think that they're preservationists and that it's that they're doing something positive.
They do think that, and I think that kind of that thinking has really got to change the museums. Not a lot of museums have changed their ways. I mean, in Illinois, you've got the Field Museum, which does a very good job of not taking undocumented antiquities, and other museums have made the step of renouncing the purchase of undocumented antiquities, and that's those museums really need to be celebrated. But there are others that I talk about in the book that are still receiving undocumented antiquities, usually as bequests or as donations from collectors. And then the collector, of course, gets a federal tax deduction in exchange for these donations. And they help keep this trade going by setting the kind of ethical climate for the trade and also by allowing collectors to donate these pieces. It's very destructive. And it's not when museums, when they take these pieces, they're not balancing the public gain by displaying these pieces. They're not balancing the damage that's done to the archaeological record. They're not understanding, and they're not comprehending that the fact that they take these pieces encourages more looting and allows this trade to keep going and to keep causing the destruction of these ancient sites.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Roger Atwood. He is a regular contributor to Art News and Archaeology magazines. His book on the subject, if you'd like to read it, is titled Stealing History, Tomb Raiders, Smugglers, and the Looting of the Ancient World. St. Martin's Press is the publisher. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Others are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. And if you're outside of the immediate area here, and it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. And we have several people here, and we'll go first to someone listening in DeWitt County, and they are on our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you're familiar with Herschel Shanks, the editor of Biblical Archaeology Review, who's been on a campaign saying that the trade in these antiquities is in part driven by now people wanting to have antiquities, but the ones that are dug up legally are squirreled away sometimes in warehouses. Like, he makes the point that there are thousands of amphora from the ancient world that are just cataloged and kept in warehouses. And why couldn't some of these things be studied, labeled as dug up properly and then sold with the for collectors, and the money put into funding more digs to try to stay ahead of the looters? I wonder if you could comment on that idea.
Sure. I have heard that proposal, and I have to say I agree with it very much. I think it would make sense, and I know on that score, I part ways with a lot of archaeologists. At the end of the book, I have some policy recommendations, and one of them is that the cultural institutes and museums in source countries that have a lot of archaeological material sells a small portion of them or some of them off into the open market to raise money for archaeological digs and to raise money for security for archaeological sites, and also to encourage rural development in the sites, in the areas around these around archaeological digs and in areas where there are great ancient, great cultural treasures under the ground, so that maybe people won't feel so obligated to loot, and that maybe that will discourage looting in the first place by offering economic incentives. I think that's a very sensible idea. It's anathema to the source countries. I mentioned that in an interview with a Peruvian official, and she absolutely went to the ceiling. I mean, the idea that these countries should sell even one piece, should it sell anything from their ancient heritage into the open market, is really an idea that they haven't quite wrapped themselves around yet. But I think it is a sensible idea. And it would also show that I think the source countries are willing to do their part in solving this problem, in combating the illegal trade in antiquities, rather than simply relying on countries like the United States or European countries to do all the effort at confiscating looted antiquities and then restituting to the country of origin. I know this is a very controversial proposal for a lot of archaeologists, but it does make sense to me. I've seen museums all over Latin America with ancient pots stacked up at the ceiling, thousands of them, warehouses of them, you know, aisle and aisle and aisle after them. And I wouldn't say they're repeated. I wouldn't say that they're all identical, but I do think that it would seem to make sense to me that there could be some kind of, like, seal system, or a system by which you, if you want to buy antiquities, you can buy an antiquity with a clean conscience, knowing that it was archaeologically excavated, that its sale was approved by the country of origin, and that you can take it home legally and stay on the right side of the law. I think that'd be a great idea. I hadn't heard Herschel Shanks make that proposal, but if he has, I completely agree.
Yeah, and one further comment about the damage that the looting does to the archaeological record. The recent scandal in Israel with the James ossuary, James, brother of Jesus, ossuary, and several of the seal rings that were unprovenance but were, you know, thought to be genuine, which are turning out almost certainly to be frauds.
Yeah.
The fact that they're unprovenance but look, you know, so good, there's so much fraud in the antiquities market, too, that... you know, it just destroys all context and leads people astray, and it's done a great deal of damage.
Well, I think that's an important point. I think when we deal in unprovenance antiquities, when we deal in antiquities that haven't been archaeologically excavated and we don't know where they're from because the looter dug them up and only the looter knows where they're from, then dealers and institutions make themselves very vulnerable to frauds because we don't have any information on where the piece is excavated. So, of course, we've got all these fakes in the market because of that. So things, you know, cases like the St. James ossuary, which I think is pretty well established to be a fake, appear in the market. And in the case of the James ossuary, it's the ossuary itself apparently is authentic, but that the inscription on it has been made in modern times.
Yeah.
But these ossuaries are everywhere. I mean, there are gazillions of them all over the Middle East.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Sure, thanks.
Let's go to another caller. This person is in Urbana, in line one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to hear more about, say, when the middleman arrives in New York with this group of stolen objects, does he go directly to known dealers, or are there middlemen in New York, or does he go to various, say, art dealers to try to sell them? Or how does it get distributed from that point?
There were a few smugglers I met in Peru who said that they would take pieces, that they would have the contacts all set up. There's one guy I met who took things to Amsterdam who said, you know, he would have the contacts already established through friends of his or through other people who are doing it. I mean, the way you would establish anything, the way you would establish trade in any area, I mean, you hear people you know who are in the business and you ask them, okay, well, who's your contact in a particular place, you know, and you do it like any other business contact. I mean, there has to be a lot of discretion involved, of course, but yes, it does. I mean, it involves a lot of discretion and it involves... But doing business contacts in the way you would with any other product. Another woman I met took things to Atlanta. She would take textiles to Atlanta, and textiles are very much the motor of the market now in the pre-Columbian trade. I mean, textiles are you know, ancient weavings are very much very coveted now by dealers because they're easy to get past, partly because they're very easy to get past airport security checks. And she would take these from Peru to Atlanta, where she had some dealer who dealt in these things. And maybe that dealer doesn't have his shop in Atlanta. He might have it elsewhere. But anyway, she had a contact in Atlanta to whom she would take these things. Other times, more with Middle Eastern antiquities or Mediterranean antiquities, they're more likely to cool their heels in a laundering point somewhere in Europe. It's often been Switzerland in the past, but laws have tightened up in Switzerland, so a lot more of that is moving to Munich in Germany. They'll often come by way of a European point to the United States, where they might be given a false, what's called a false provenance, which is a document with a fake but plausible-sounding history of the object, asserting that the object had been in a collection for many, many years, from dating from before the development of laws in this country restricting illicit antiquities from entering this country. So there are lots of ways of doing this. The antiquities trade has developed lots of tricks and techniques for getting these things into this country in violation often of U.S. law, and has developed the business context necessary to do that.
Does it call? Does that get at your question?
Yes, thank you.
All right, let's go to Indiana for another person here. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. This is sort of an anecdote that sort of leans towards a question, but it may be so out of date, it may not have anything to do with what you're observing now. But in the early 60s, when I was a graduate student in Chapel Hill, I had a group of friends from different disciplines, anthropology, history, philosophy, maths, and psychologists and stuff that were all graduate students. And we'd meet every once in a while at each other's houses, and one night I received a call, not particularly late, but late in the sense that, you know, for graduate students should be studying. I went over to a fellow's house, and we all sat down, and everybody was sort of somber. I really didn't know what was going on. All of a sudden, one fellow who looked rather distinguished, and he had a girlfriend, and they were introduced, and it turned out both of them have had fellowships, traveling fellowships to the Middle East and the Mediterranean area. And all of a sudden, he brought out a leather bag, which, you know, to a graduate student that didn't have much money, it looked like it was worth quite a bit. And he started pulling out Greek coins and small figurines, put them on a large table, and started talking about their history, and actually started selling them. And some of the people was in school with came from rather nice families. And I was told after the meeting was over and the fellow left and sold a few things that he was one of the finest families in the East and, you know, that kind of thing. And I was just wondering, of course, this is over 40 years ago, and things maybe have been a lot looser for getting through customs and stuff, but is there a class element in this sort of thing in any way whatsoever, or at least, you know, in terms of the people who are some of the in-betweeners, could this still type of stuff be going on, graduate students you know, making a little bit on the side where they're studying a culture at the same time and then bringing them back into the country and, you know, and selling them.
Yeah, sure. It would be very difficult, I think, for an archaeologist or a graduate student in archaeology to be taking out things illegally from the country of origin. I mean, everything, if you're an archaeologist, you know, as I'm sure you know, if you're an archaeologist working in a developing country, you're supposed to hand over everything all the objects you excavate go to the National Cultural Institute or some local museum. That's one reason why there were so many objects in the Iraqi Museum in Baghdad in 2003, was because these archaeologists had been working there for decades and decades and had handed over all the objects that they excavated to the museum. So I don't think that happens very often with graduate students these days. I mean, there might, you know, sometimes you hear rumors about cases like that, but I don't get the impression it's very common, and I'm sure that archaeologists who did that, if it were discovered, they would come under professional sanction and would be if they were caught, would be banned from doing archaeological work in their particular country. But when people you asked if there's a class element, and well, maybe there is. I think there isn't. There is this feeling that antiquities grant status and privilege and power, that they're a sign of privilege and status, and I think that's one of the things that's kept the antiquities trade going for so long. The trade in undocumented antiquities has benefited from this idea that collecting antiquities is a prestige hobby, and I would hope we would move away from that, because it's a very destructive kind of thinking that's resulted in the destruction of a lot of ancient sites to feed this trade. I mean, the way that we moved against it in the ivory trade, I mean, people used to have this idea that elephant ivory was a very prestige thing to own, and that kind of thinking encouraged the poaching of elephants all over Africa until there were international treaties that were designed to restrict the trade in elephant ivory, and because there was a greater public consciousness about the fact that when you buy ivory, you are, you know, encouraging the poaching of elephants. And I think that that comparison is very apt with the antiquities trade, because this residual idea that you can show your good taste or your connoisseurship by buying these pieces is quite obsolete, I hope, and a kind of thinking that I think needs to change, because these pieces, like the friend you mentioned in Chapel Hill who put the person who puts these things on the table, you know, these figures that he's putting on the table are presumably, you know, extracted illegally from tombs if they weren't archaeologically excavated, and we don't really know very much about them. We won't know particularly where they're from if they've been taken by looters.
Yeah, I realized while we were, all of us were there, and I looked around, and most of the people were there that came from, you know, were people who had fellowships like I did, but they didn't need them, let's put it that way. And this fellow seemed to have, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, but he had a lot of connections, and he mentioned a lot of names, some of them which I knew, you know, and certainly most of the people in the room knew the people. And I just when I remember I left there, and I had this impression of, boy, there's this incredible network of wealthy people, you know, removing things from other countries, and then into that, I was never asked back because I never purchased anything. I didn't have that kind of money to buy these things, and so I lost contact with the group. And this is the first time I've even, you know, thought about it. When David had you come on the show to talk, I thought I'd just hop in and give that little anecdote there and give my 2 cents. And thanks a lot.
Okay. Well,
no, thank you.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Roger Atwood. He's a journalist. He's a regular contributor to Art News and Archaeology magazines. He has also written on culture and politics, and his articles have appeared in The New Republic, Mother Jones, The Nation, The Washington Post. If you're interested in reading on this subject we're discussing here, he has authored a book that you can look for. It's relatively new and should be out in the bookstores if you want to take a look at it. The book is titled Stealing History: Tomb Raiders, Smugglers, and the Looting of the Ancient World. Is published by St. Martin's Press. The countries where the material is being removed, they are indeed trying to protect sites. They are trying to prevent the export of this material. And then countries where the material either it might be shipped to that place or through that place, like the United States, for example, they are trying to find this material that's being brought into the United States. But perhaps you could talk a little bit about how governments and law enforcement of those governments are trying to deal with the trade, both when you look at the country of origin, say Peru, for example, because that's where you spend a lot of time and you write a lot about that in the book, and say the United States, which often is a place where this material is shipped. Either it's going to go through here to someplace else, or it's coming here and we have somebody here who then will take it and then sell it or pass it on to somebody else.
Right. Well, there's been a lot more cooperation in the last, it's been gradually increasing, but in the last 10 years especially, there's been much, much more cooperation between the United States and other governments in stopping this trade. And it you know, you can always criticize it for being too tardy or not being forthright enough. I mean, there's plenty to criticize, but it's there has been a law enforcement response to this, and police forces all over the country, in this country, I'll start talking about the United States, are just now, or in the last few years, have realized the extent of this trade. I talk about the New York City Police Department apprehending some Mayan stonework, some looted and smuggled Mayan stonework in 1999 and 2000, and how the New York Police Department just started coming across this whole underground trade that they didn't even realize was going on, and there it was. And you know, they were dumping all these things at the consulate of Guatemala in Manhattan, you know, and just finding all these things, that finding this whole trade that they didn't realize what was going on. So I think even local law enforcement departments around the United States are realizing the extent and the volume of this trade. The FBI has just set up an art theft team, a special art theft unit, with two what are called roving prosecutors who can prosecute cases all over the United States. And that's also dealing with art theft, you know, stolen paintings and the like, but they do definitely deal with smuggled antiquities. And I think that does show the seriousness with which the federal government views this problem. It's not a huge team. It's about nine people, but it does show that this is an area that's moving, you know, a lot of stolen property, and that is an area of great concern to the United States from lots of points of view. In the source countries, the one, of course, I can speak of with the most experience is Peru, where they have put a lot of efforts into they put more efforts into trying to stop things as they're leaving the country. If you leave Peru now, your carry-on bags are X-rayed, and if the image of a pot or any kind of jar sort of flickers onto the screen, then you get you have your bag opened, and they will inspect. They send you over to this desk with an art historian and an archaeologist who will look over the particular piece in your bag and decide if it's authentic. And if it's authentic, they confiscate it from you. They don't punish you. They don't give you a fine or anything, but they do take it back from you. So, and I've every time I've left Peru, I've seen that desk there, and they do seize things from people. And the idea is to sort of, discourage people, maybe start discouraging people from selling these things to foreign visitors to Peru. I mean, it's not to sort of frighten people. It's just to maybe discourage Peruvians themselves from selling the people these pieces if they know that they run the risk of having them confiscated at the airport and losing, whatever money they spent for them. Unfortunately, that system doesn't get the real motor of the market these days, which is textiles. That's really what's hot in the market these days. As I was saying, these ancient weavings, those you can just, stuff into dirty T-shirts and take them out of the country, and they won't show up on these kinds of X-rays, I mean, unless you do a hand inspection. But they're all, the Peruvians are also, and Peruvians in other countries in parts of Central America and West Africa, they're working with archaeologists, the local officials are working with local people to develop these anti-looting brigades, these kind of patrols that go around with binoculars, and they're local villagers who keep an eye on ancient sites, ancient cemeteries, and burial mounds, around their farm fields in rural areas, and do sort of citizens' arrests when they see professional grave robbers coming to dig up sites. It's been quite effective. It's worked on a pretty small scale in Peru, and to some extent it's pushed the problem elsewhere. But, on a small scale, it has really worked quite a bit. And it's also been combined with education campaigns to get people in rural areas. And, this is really where the battle for preserving the past is going to be won or lost, in these rather remote rural areas in places like the coast of Peru. Getting people in these places to think about their archaeological sites not as this windfall to exploit, something that you could just sort of dig up once and then sell, but rather, a community resource like good roads or clean well water or fields free from erosion or free from salinization, getting them to think about these sites as areas that can bring a community, that can bring resources to the community through archaeology, through tourism, and also to help them see it as, a piece of their past, a piece of their identity. And it's been quite effective. I mean, more effective than you might expect.
Do archaeologists ever deal with looters?
They do, in a kind of, in a strange way. I mean, archaeology, looting is this kind of evil twin to archaeology, because looters often find the sites that archaeologists later excavate. And some of the more, I think, honest archaeologists will admit that they'll, looters often kind of test a site in a way. They will, sink looters' shafts into a particular site, dig up some things, and then archaeologists find out about that site, about the importance of the site and what's there, when those pieces that the looters dug up actually start hitting the market and start getting sold, and the archaeologists get wind of them, that the galleries are starting to sell these pieces. That's certainly what happened in Sipan. This was a very important case of looting and archaeology in 1987, one of the really most important archaeological discoveries in Latin America of the 20th century. This was a site that was discovered by looters in February 16th, 1987, because I interviewed the looters, and they these pieces, they were these fabulous pieces, these gold and silver funerary items started circulating to the whole market very, very quickly, London and Los Angeles, and then, of course, and in Peru as well, of course, and the archaeologists got wind of this, and as did the police, so the police chased off the looters, and then the archaeological excavation started. So you had this kind of comparison, this almost kind of minute-by-minute comparison of what looting does and what archaeology does. But I don't think that archaeologists would have ever found that tomb. That really changed our whole understanding of the quality of art and the way art was used in societies, in pre-Columbian societies. If it weren't for these looters, archaeologists had worked at that site before and had left. They'd moved on because they didn't think there was anything there. But these looters kept working. They found it.
In museums around this country and in Europe, there is material that was removed from from Latin America, from Africa, from around the Mediterranean, from the Near East, from East Asia, from Southeast Asia. Material that certainly is part of those countries' cultural heritage that arguably was looted. How do museums think about that? And also, what, because there have been attempts from time to time for countries on a governmental level to say, look, this material was removed from our country, whatever the circumstances were, whether it was with permission of a past government or not, they'd say, this really belongs to us. It's our cultural heritage, and really it should be repatriated. It should be here. And museums have dealt with that in different sorts of ways. I suppose you could argue if the museums gave back everything like that, there might not be too much left in their galleries.
Sure.
How do museums think about these days? And then how have countries, what sort of countries have success have countries had in asking for material back?
Museums, they have gotten, a lot of museums have gotten in trouble for having things in their collection that have every sign of having been looted and smuggled out of their country of origin. The Metropolitan Museum of Art was faced legal action from the government of Turkey over a very large stash of funerary items, which, well, the two sides eventually settled out of court, and the Metropolitan returned the whole lot to Turkey. The Boston Museum of Fine Arts has come under a lot of pressure from Guatemala to return some wonderful Mayan vases in that museum's collection. And I think that as these demands from countries pile up for the return of these pieces, and as this pattern starts to get established of museums receiving looted and smuggled antiquities, I think it's led to museums to put more resources into doing the research into these things and to finding out where the pieces actually came from, so they don't face these kinds of legal problems. The issue of Holocaust art is also put with art that was looted from Jewish Holocaust victims in World War II and then finding its way to the United States and into American museums. That also has put a lot of pressure on museums to put much greater resources into investigating the background of these things they buy rather than just going onto the market and buying anything that looks nice and that shows up. And it's put museums under a lot of pressure. They've had to think much more about provenance issues in ways they never did. Now, there aren't really that many restitution demands from countries on museums. And museums talk about how if they start giving back things, well, then we'll get these wholesale demands, we'll have to empty our galleries, we'll have to be shipping all this stuff back to these countries. And that really isn't the case, that there aren't that many cases of that actually happening. And I think we see, for example, with the Native American, this is a internal to the United States, but I think it's a very apt comparison, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990. That act allowed for Native American groups to request pieces back from museums. If a particular piece was considered sacred or important to a Native American group, then the museum would have to give the piece back, basically have to give the piece back in most cases to the Native American group. And when this law went through, you had all these museums and all these museum organizations saying, oh, no, you know, we're going to have these Indians coming up, driving up with their U-Hauls and demanding we give all this stuff back and emptying our galleries and giving all these things back. And that didn't happen. It didn't happen at all because people are responsible, and people and ethnic groups in the United States, indigenous groups in this country, were selective about the pieces that they asked back. They asked for truly important pieces. And I think that's true of source countries as well, source countries for looted antiquities. They're not demanding wholesale restitution of pieces. They are demanding that museums stop buying or stop acquiring, either through purchase or through donation or bequest, pieces that show all signs of having been looted and smuggled out of the country of origin.
We have about 10 minutes left, actually a little bit less in this hour of Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guest, Roger Atwood. His book, if you would like to read more on the subject, is Stealing History, Tomb Raiders, Smugglers, and the Looting of the Ancient World, published by St. Martin's Press. We have a caller we'll get right to, and we might get in one or two in the time that remains. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in a nearby community, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Unfortunately, I haven't heard your entire conversation this morning, but you did touch on something that the thing I was going to ask about, and that is I have an interest in artifacts that are found on the surface. You know, you find arrowheads and various trinkets and stuff that were used in early American, what do we want to call them, societies. And the question I have is that all over this part of the United States, there are burial mounds. Now, I would not want to dig one of those up, but the question comes to me that if you own the piece of property that this spot is on, does that become your property, or does it remain the people's property?
It depends on the state. There are lawyers who know this inside and out, so I don't know too much about the subject, you know, within the borders of the United States. But on all federal land, all that's very well protected. I mean, legally very well protected. There are big problems with looting in this country, in the Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, huge problems with that. Cerro Verde is a place in Colorado which was looted back in Teddy Roosevelt's time. And that case, which is very scandalous in the beginning of the 20th century, caused a great public outcry. That was the case that got cultural property legislation going in this country. Of course, you know, made people think about the problem of looting in this country was Cerro Verde. Certain states do have protections on archaeological sites ancient sites on private land. I don't know about Illinois. Indiana does. Indiana has very strong legislation on that. Some states in New England do as well. You'd have to consult your state government on that. But there's no. The United States is actually one of the very few countries in the world that doesn't have national central government protection for archaeological resources on private land, on discovered and undiscovered underground treasures on private land. It has there's no federal protection for that. But as I said, on anything, on any government land, it is very much protected.
Yeah, I knew that all government lands were protected, but I just wonder, you know,
sure.
And if you walk, if something you pick up on the surface, is that protected as much as something that is buried? There is a, you know, there's a fine line there, you know, something
totally
discarded. Some of these things would be just discarded items, you know, that would not really have an archaeological value, but then other things are very, very culturally entangled in things, you know?
Well, the things that are on the surface, taking things on the surface, that's not as destructive as actually sinking holes. And the laws that are on the books, I think, are they're not aimed at people who find things on the surface or find arrowheads or other things on the surface. I think it's aimed more at the idea of people buying tracts of land and then sinking holes in them or using heavy machinery in them to demolish ancient sites to extract a few of the most valuable pieces, and then destroying all the physical record and the historical record that's contained in that site. So I don't think that I think you'd have to ask a lawyer about that, just what the sort of distinction is between things that are found on the surface versus things that are found underground. I think any archaeologist would agree that it's much more destructive to actually sink holes into a particular site rather than picking up things off the ground. But the law is varies from state to state in that area.
Yeah. To bring an example, Cahokia, which is down near St. Louis.
Cahokia, yeah, I really want to visit that site. I hear it's very fascinating.
Yeah, back in the earlier years in the country, they leveled these mounds just to plant, make the farmers could use the ground, and at the same time destroyed many archaeological sites.
Huh, extraordinary. I mean, it's a good story. I mean, the way in which indigenous ancient sites in this country, particularly in the Mississippi Valley, are being treated. I mean, there are big problems with people, and I've understood in Arkansas, in Mississippi, with people on private land destroying ancient sites. I think people shouldn't do that, obviously. I think it's, these sites should be excavated properly by archaeologists.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We are pretty much at the point here where we're going to have to stop. is there something very quick you could say in... you mentioned the fact that, indeed, in the book, at the end of the book, you have some suggestions for things that should be done to address the problem.
Yeah, I think people in general, I think when people buy antiquities that don't have a pedigree, that haven't been archaeologically excavated, or don't have any clear documentation that they're out of the ground before 1983, which is when the United States ratified the UNESCO Treaty on Cultural Protection on protection of cultural property, then people really shouldn't buy things. I mean, when you go to a gallery and see antiquities that don't have any information on their previous ownership, they don't have any sign of having been in a previous collection, they don't have any sign of having been archaeologically excavated, then I don't think people should buy them. I think that's what contributes to this trade. And I think once you go to the bottom of the antiquities trade, you realize and you see really what kind of damage this does. That's what I hope this book does, make people see really where these pieces actually come from.
Well, there we must leave it. Again, if people want to read the book we've talked about, the title Stealing History, published by St. Martin's Press, by our guest Roger Atwood. And Mr. Atwood, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, first broadcast in April of 2005. All of our past programs, well, not all, but many past programs available at WILL.UIUC.edu. The broadcast made possible today in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta now offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta, 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. In the next hour, we'll have another program from the Focus Archives. First, though, we will break, as usual, for news and an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade in the soybean pit. Fund selling and long speculative liquidation continue to weigh on futures. Funds sold an estimated 3,000 contracts thus far this morning. Losses in the neighboring corn market and in outside markets are further pressuring prices as well. Soybean futures are off the early